so much. It's a pleasure to give this talk. When I was asked to give a talk for this particular workshop, I thought, well, I'm not really working on that stuff, but I have some interest in the area and some tangential research. So I thought what I would do is give a talk that's sort of a bit of an overview of a lot of people's work, most of it not mine. I'll just confess up front, I put this talk together early this morning, so it's hot off the press, which means it may have some discombobulation, hopefully not too much. And number two, that I'm not really an expert in a lot of the things I'm going to talk about. So if you have detailed questions about other people's work, I'm going to defer them to reading their papers or talking to them rather than having me try to field. I mean, I'll do my best, but I may just tell you to read their paper. Because, you know, there's a lot of different things here. So let me also thank a number of my young colleagues who have given me slides that are in this talk, some of them from their own talks, some of them just some computational results in this talks. And many of these are, I think everybody here is a collaborator, former student, current student, postdoc in my research group. And a lot of these people have gotten me interested in some of the topics that I'm going to talk about. Okay, so this is actually a slide I borrowed from Shivan Dai, who's a postdoc here in the group. But this just shows the kind of phenomena in real life that we're interested in modeling. This is an alloy, and we're looking at a time sequence here, and we're looking at particles that are. These are sort of small nucleations that slowly over time get bigger, and as they get bigger, you notice that the total number per, you know, if you measure the density as a function of the number of these particles per, you know, sort of fixed area, you see that the number density goes down and the particle size go up and the total number decreases. And you may wonder, does this process have any sort of regular pattern? I mean, we're starting with fairly random initial condition. For people who like to work with things like self-similar behavior, it's not just clear from looking at this that there's necessarily any sort of reason or rhyme to what's going on here.
But the mass is conserved, right? It's just coarsening?
Okay, again, not an expert, but... a lot of the problems I'm going to talk about are mass conserved systems, but not all of them are. Yeah, good question. Okay, so this is Oswald ripening. Again, I'm not an expert in this either, but you do see these are. I don't have the times here. I should have put those on there. These are increasing time, and you see that it's the same. This is we're not changing the size of the region we're looking at. This is the same region, and you see that these small spots over a period of time undergo this very dramatic coarsening process. Okay, so it turns out this kind of behavior there's a long literature in this stuff. And there's, I guess, sort of a renewed interest in coarsening in the mathematics and applied mathematics community really in the last sort of 5 to 7 years. I'm going to talk about a lot of different models for all sorts of different problems. And they really span the gamut from, you know, sort of some of the classical PDE models. These are local differential equations. The Allen-Kahn equation is, there is both a conservative and a non-conservative form for Allen-Kahn. Kahn-Hilliard equation is conservative. Thin film equations are conservative. These two are fourth order. This is second order. We also have classes of integrated differential equations, so they involve non-local operators, but otherwise have a lot of similar properties to the PDE models. Then once you look at these categories of problems, you can look at sharp interface models like Mullins-Zakarka surface diffusion and curvature motion. And all of these things sort of lend themselves to simplified ODE type models, mean field and ODE models. There are mean field and ODE models where there's no motion of interfaces, and then there are also discrete models that are also ODE-like models where there is motion. So lots of different classes of problems, a number of which there are some really nice, fairly new results, both sort of heuristic and rigorous results for these problems. So it's a very active area of research. So I'm going to start with a brief review of the Kahn-Hilliard equation. I think we've heard about that a lot at IPAM the last couple of weeks. But, you know, for people who haven't heard about it or just people who want So this is the Kahn-Hilliard equation, and the Kahn-Hilliard equation is built around this very simple free energy. So we have a smooth function u, and the free energy is defined as follows. It's a sum of two terms. The second term here is a double well potential. So the typical choice, I mean, you can choose anything you want to, but you know, a typical choice would be to have u take on, say, values 0 and 1. So the double well is would be u squared times 1 minus u squared in that case. And so this is sort of a regular, so this term basically, if you think about minimizing this energy, if you just have this term here, well, it's a double well with two, you know, it's symmetric and two local minima. So the solution's either going to want to go in this one or this one, depending on which one it's closer to. Okay, so that's pretty boring. What makes it really interesting is you take that somewhat boring double well potential and you tack on a regularizer here. It says, well, we kind of want to go into either 0 or 1. That's a that'll basically turn your solution into a binary problem. But, well, now this is going to keep it from being completely binary because if it's binary, you're going to have jump discontinuities in u. You don't want to do that exactly. So what you do is you put a regularizing effect in there. So you add a smoothing term which says, well, if you have a jump discontinuity, then this term becomes unbounded. Okay, if you just think about the gradient of u, integrate the gradient of u squared. So when we stick this in, this forbids us to have jump discontinuities, and epsilon introduces a scale to the problem. So if I write it like this, then epsilon is, if you can just count, you can just do dimensional analysis on this and see this epsilon plays the role of a length scale in the problem.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
There is absolutely no constraint on the volume, which is inside the blue
I'm
or
not
red.
Done
or
yet.
Huh?
Okay, just be patient.
All code.
Okay. Okay, so now what we do, what do we do with this energy? Well, we do a gradient flow, but not in the standard L2 interproduct, in an H-1 interproduct, and that's where you get your conservation of volume, right there, is by doing an H-1 flow, which gives you this PDE. So if you're wondering what is H-1 gradient flow, well, that's a long story, but I'll just write the equation down. That's the simplest thing to do. And there's the equation. That is the very famous Kahn-Hilliard equation. But the Kahn-Hilliard equation does now, if we start with an initial condition, we could take the initial condition to say be, so this is a periodic geometry here in 2D. We could take our initial condition to be at time zero to be, say, a half with some small random fluctuations in the data. So what will happen is it will very quickly segregate into regions that are either 0 or 1, represented here by the red and the blue areas. But those regions are going to be separated by a small interface, but the interface is actually completely smooth and it has scale epsilon. So you can think of this as a two-scale problem. So if we look at this picture right here, we immediately say, oh, it's a two-scale problem. We've got the epsilon scale, and then we've got the large scale, the system size. Now we run it forward in time, and we see it's much more complex than that. Okay, so we see that the system is actually undergoing what I would call statistical coarsening, meaning that there really is a third length scale in the problem, which is the typical scale of these islands, and that scale changes in time; it's time dependent. And if you do very careful, high precision numerical calculations with random initial data, you see that it actually obeys a power law behavior. And some people often refer to this as self-similarity. It's not exact self-similarity, meaning that I can't, if I take a little tiny slice of this at time zero and then let it evolve to a later time, it won't be a carbon copy of what I get for the whole square at a later time, but it will have the same sort of general kind of structure with just a change of scale. So I'll just repeat that calculation. Okay, so that's the Kahn-Hilliard equation. Also notice that there are other interesting events, like there was one of these spots went away here, this spot's disappearing, and this one's going to disappear too. So the entire mass is conserved, but locally you don't see local mass conservation because this is a diffuse interface method, so the mass can sort of leak through the diffuse interface. Okay, this is often also referred to as a phase field model. You may have heard the word phase field, so that's an example of phase field. Yeah.
Does the initial interface scale stay constant, though?
Oh, the epsilon?
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. In fact, you know, there's beautiful work. I mean, there's beautiful work that goes way back on this problem. Bob Pago has a famous paper from 1988 or 89, where he calculates he does formal asymptotics on this problem, and derives a curve evolution equation for this interface because of the fact that you have separation of scales, meaning that this scale is long compared to this scale in this direction. So you can actually do an expansion separation of scales, and then that's been made rigorous by Ali Kako's base and Chen. That's, you know, about 5 years after that. There's lots of work in this area. I'm going to show an example later in the talk of a more recent problem that we've been working on here, where we use that kind of idea. Yes.
And what is the limiting picture here? If time goes to
infinity. If time goes to infinity, well, it depends on the data. Actually, it depends on the geometry of the box and on the data. But, you know, we often just see it go to a single stripe at the end. Single stripe is stable. It's a stable configuration.
So graphically, it looks like no movement by mean curvature.
It's not. This is actually a Mullins-Sokarko flow, and the limit as epsilon goes to zero. So if you take the Allen-Kahn equation is basically this problem without this Laplacian and a minus sign here. That's Allen-Kahn. So if you run Allen-Kahn, then you get mean curvature flow in the epsilon to zero limit. This we don't get mean curvature flow here. We get Mullins-Sokarko flow, which is a non-local free boundary problem. So it turns out that for the Kahn-Hilliard problem, this new length scale that I mentioned actually scales like t to the 1/3 power. And this scaling behavior is actually mimicked in a number of other coarsening models. However, you can make a simple change to the model, namely you can add a degenerate mobility to the Kahn-Hilliard equation, which can give you surface diffusion and the epsilon to zero limit at all, and that turns out to change the coarsening rate for this problem. Also, here's a discussion of mean curvature flow in Allen-Kahn. Those kinds of problems have a different power law. So this kind of coarsening problem that I'm showing just one example of here. There are a lot of common behaviors from one problem to another, but then some of the details, like the power law, for example, may be different depending on the problem we're interested in. Since IPAM is an institute that likes to bring, you know, rigorous mathematics and areas of science together, I want to mention that there's been a very powerful mathematical method, rigorous method, that was developed by Felix Otto and Bob Cohn. Published about 5 years ago, now called the Cohn-Otto method, for getting a rigorous bound for coarsening rates for some of these problems. And this idea has really taken off, and since their original paper about 5 years ago, there's been a slew of papers written on many different problems deriving rigorous bounds for coarsening rates. So I thought I'd just kind of go, this is actually a slide Shivan gave me. Shivan is an expert on this stuff. And I thought I'd just kind of walk you through some of the ideas that go into this paper here. So their original paper was a paper specifically on the Kahn-Hilliard equation. And now, by the way, I mentioned degenerate mobility. So degenerate mobility, for example, would put in, like, say, if this is one type of degenerate mobility,
that's
put in.
Well, is it plus or minus one?
Sorry?
Well, is it plus or minus one instead of zero?
So in this case, the well is a plus or minus one. Yeah. I've got slides from different people here. Like I promised a discombobulation, and this is an example of one. So keeps you guys on your toes, though, which is good. So the problem then, one of the problems involves how do we rigorously define this new length scale in the problem? And so the art to doing rigorous bounds. One of the arts involves how do you construct this length scale, and the construction is different for different problems. If you go and read the literature, you'll see that how they define the length scale is somewhat problem specific, and that's one of the challenges in coming up with a rigorous proof here. For example, if we take u to be mean zero, we can define the gradient inverse applied to u. We can take an inverse of that operator, and then we can just define this to be a length scale. And then you can also write this as a minimization problem as well, which turns out to be useful for deriving a bound. So basically, you define that thing, and then you need to come up with an interpolation inequality and a dissipation relation, and then basically you put all of this together, and you get an ODE-like estimate. And the ODE-like estimate is typically an estimate for the energy as a function of time. And these are somewhat crude bounds, meaning that typically they involve integrals in time of the energy. In this case, it's energy squared or energy cubed as a function of time. So these estimates are kind of reflective of what you see in the real calculations or in real physics. But notice that they're very crude bounds compared to, you know, so if you actually go and compute these things numerically, you often see almost perfect power law scaling. But it turns out that that scaling is very dependent on the initial condition. And these estimates are true for very, very general classes of initial data, not ones that have, you know, certain types of statistics, which is why we have to end up with a fairly crude bound rather than saying that the energy exactly scales like a power. Okay, so we get an upper bound, but not a lower bound in particular. Okay, so you may wonder, what are the conditions for cone auto? What are the conditions on U? Well, they're really simple. So the conditions are a bound on the energy at time zero. We may need zero mean condition. We just have a couple of very simple constraints on the energy. And then we get these rigorous bounds. And there's been quite a lot of very nice papers on all sorts of different models. We have, for example, Shivan Dai, who's a postdoc. Is Shivan here today? I don't know, maybe he's teaching this. He might be teaching right now. Well, Shivan is a postdoc here in the math department. He did his PhD thesis with Bob Pago, and he has worked on some rigorous results in a number of models, including LSW, which is an ODE particle model related to the Klein-Hilliard equation. Okay. So lots of good literature there. I want to mention a few. I'm not going to go over all these papers, but I want to mention a couple that I thought might be of interest to the community here. In particular, this last very recent preprint by Asadoglu and Greer. Salim Asadoglu was a postdoc with us at UCLA for about 3 years, CAM postdoc. He's now at Michigan, and John Greer was my PhD student. And they actually never really overlapped here, I think, at UCLA, but they've worked together on a problem. And this is actually, their result is not concerning a PDE model, but actually concerning a finite difference approximation of an ill-posed problem. So that's really remarkable that you can take something that at face value looks really different from the stuff that we're looking at here, yet apply this kind of analysis. So they're looking at ill-posed nonlinear problems. So for example, if you take just a very simple two-dimensional or one-dimensional PDE like this. So this is a nonlinear diffusion equation. And we look at the case where the diffusion equation has this function R is actually not convex. So here's an example of a non-convex function, R. This particular equation arises in a well-known model for image processing for denoising due to Perona and Malik. Those of you in image processing know the Perona-Malik model. And if you look at the equation for the derivative, you get something that looks like this. So one of the remarkable things about Perona-Malik is it's linearly ill-posed due to the non-convexity of this function. However, if you write down a very simple finite difference scheme for the problem and integrate forward in time numerically, the solution never blows up. It really behaves quite well. And it behaves so well that people use this all the time to do image processing. So what's going on? Well, it turns out that the instability, this ill-posedness, leads to what's called a staircase instability. So for example, if we start with an initial condition that is a slope, okay, this is for Perona-Malik, and we just jiggle it a little bit, well, the numerics will do that for us because it's a numerical approximation. And if the slope is big enough, then what will happen is very quickly the solution will, instead of having a nice linear slope, it'll turn into a bunch of little tiny staircases with the jumps being in random locations depending on the initial data. Okay? And so these stairs will be very fine scale, and they'll be fine scale on the scale of the grid, of the numerical grid. So the numerical grid is basically determining the initial fine scale for the problem. And then if you let it go forward in time, what happens is these stairs start to run into each other. So they'll merge, and two little stairs will merge and form a bigger stair. So we're looking at a bunch of different times here, snapshots, superimposed, until finally at the end of the day, you just have one course jump. So there's a time-dependent coarsening process going on in this problem.
So if I understand the picture,
yeah.
You're looking at the initial time and two intermediate times.
Initial time.
And it's representing the two intermediate times with dotted lines of different lengths and thicknesses, which gives the somewhat bizarre look for the unit. So I'm actually looking at four curves here.
Yeah, they have another picture. I just don't have enough space in my talk to show all their pictures. They have another picture where they show the derivative of this, which is just some spikes. And you see lots of little spikes and some bigger spikes. And, you know, that's basically what you see, yes.
So the location of the staircase, is it deterministic or is it also made by the fluctuation?
It'll be made by small changes in the fluctuations of the initial data.
So it could be at 0.2 or 0.8.
So that would violate conservation. The integral has to be invariant.
Right.
So it has to be located at 0.2.
Well, the final one, yes, the final one is here. But you know, where the initial little steps are will depend on the data.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's right. I thought that's what you were asking me, the initial data versus... Oh, you were asking me about this final one. Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I didn't understand the question. Okay, so... So there's also, they actually have in their paper another example which involves shear bands in granular media. The equation is almost identical to the Perron-Malik equation, but for a completely different application. So it's a physics application for granular media. It's a one-dimensional model, and it undergoes this very same coarsening process. So the punchline, you should go read their paper if you want to see the details. But the punchline is they've been able to take the Kawanato rigorous framework and apply it to both of these problems, the numerical approximations for these problems. So that's sort of a new application for this kind of a method. So what I thought I'd do is to show you some other examples that undergo coarsening for which there really has not been any sort of, I guess, either rigorous or heuristic theory derived, but for which we probably can do that kind of work. So these are problems in biological aggregations that have come out of some research here at UCLA. Lincoln Chase, who's my colleague sitting in the front row, has been involved in some of this work. And these are models for large-scale coordinated movements where there is no centralized motion of the movement, and for which we typically have, again, separation of scales like in all these problems. There's an interaction length scale which is very small compared to the typical group size. And these kinds of aggregation behaviors are seen in many different animal populations, like insects. This is a locust swarm. This is a wildebeest herd, and this is a fish school. Now, the individual patterns, you know, the shapes of the patterns may be different, but the aggregation phenomenon seems to be somewhat universal. So, here's a particular model that Chad Topaz, myself, and Mark Lewis derived in a paper that just appeared last year in Bulletin of Math Biology. And this is a model that is general, it works in n-space dimensions, and it basically looks at the physical scales and the physical processes associated with aggregations and sort of derives a very general, overarching model with sort of the minimal amount of assumptions that make sense physically for this problem. So in particular, we have social attraction, meaning that that your animals will sense each other using whatever mechanism they use for sensing on some fairly near scale. So for example, they could just look around and see, okay, where are my pals? Oh, they're over there, okay. So they're over there, I'm gonna make sort of a coarse grain approximation. I'm going to sort of integrate over the whole group where everybody is, and I see that, well, they're kind of generally in that direction, so I'm going to go over there. People do this, animals do this. If you see a bunch of people over there, you might think, well, they know something I don't know, so I'm going to go over there and see what they know. So this is a process of climbing gradients, but typically it's done in an average sense. So the K is the averaging kernel here. Now, in addition, if you get really, really close to each other, you're going to tend to move apart because you don't want to be too overcrowded. And the point here is that the overcrowding scales differently from the aggregation. In particular, the overcrowding scales with both the gradient of the population density and with the density itself. If the density is rather diffuse, then you don't need to disperse too much. Okay. Likewise, if the gradient of the population is very small, then there really isn't a good place to go, so you're still not going to disperse very much. So with these two processes scaling differently, having different powers of rho, we get beautiful pattern-forming systems out of this model. So here again is coarsening. At time zero, we start with a very random, sort of unstructured initial condition on a large domain. And you see very quickly it settles down into some number of bumps, and the bumps start to run into each other, and eventually there's one super bump. And this is our population, this is our long time limit of the population. This model also we can think of as a gradient flow. It turns out that it has an energy, and this is the energy for this system here. So you see there's our averaging kernel there, and there's the two terms, and this is also, like all the other energies we've looked at, I didn't mention this back before, but I'll say it now, these are non-convex energies. And you need that to observe these kinds of interesting dynamics in the models. So using this energy, we can see immediately what bump is going to be the preferred bump for the long time limit. That's it's just a two-line back of the envelope calculation. And it allows us to not only get what the bump shape is, but also it allows us to predict that as the total mass of the swarm gets bigger and bigger and bigger, the swarm will approximate basically a pancake shape. It'll be flat on top with steep sides, and the height of this bump approaches a constant value, a constant density, which is a feature that's often seen in real populations, that there is sort of a constant density that's achieved for very large swarms. Okay, so that's another example of a continuum model. It's an integro-differential equation rather than a PDE model, so it's a non-local system rather than a local system. So another class of models for which there probably is some really interesting coarsening dynamics, but which really haven't been studied from that point of view, are discrete particle swarming models. And this is some work from a recent paper with what I mentioned with Lincoln, Maria Dorsanya, who's a postdoc here at UCLA, and Yao Li Chuang, who's just finished his PhD. So these are particle models where what we do is we basically plunk down a bunch of particles. You can think of them as representing fish in the ocean, for example, although we don't put in the hydrodynamics. We're just looking at particle interactions. And each particle has a velocity v sub I, and that velocity is changing according to a very simple set of rules. So there's going to be energy put into the system by this alpha, and all that is it's self-propulsion in the direction you're already going, okay? So I'm going this direction, okay, I'm going to, keep the motor moving. This term here is drag, okay? That just says the medium, it provides me some resistance against motion, okay? So that introduces drag, and typically the drag scales differently from self-propulsion. That would be a good thing because if there were no other particles in the system, you'd like this system to reach some kind of equilibrium, which it does, at a constant speed, square root of alpha over beta. Now, we're going to make the problem interesting by adding interactions between the particles, and we do that using pairwise potentials. Okay, we pick up one potential, and we introduce pairwise interactions through some kind of potential. In this case, we've chosen a Morse potential, which is in a lot of papers in the literature. We liked it because we saw some really interesting patterns in an earlier paper from Herbie Levine's group down at San Diego that appeared about 7 years ago in the literature. So it turns out if you take this model and you plop down a bunch of particles with random initial directions and you turn on the model and you let them go, they do some really interesting things. They form, for example, mill vortices like this. Okay. One of the really interesting things we've discovered about this system is that there is a notion or a behavior pairwise interaction potential called H stability, which goes way back into the literature in thermodynamics, back, you know, decades in that literature, which is well known for Hamiltonian systems, conservative systems, which turns out to play a very important role for these non-conservative systems as well. So the system is non-conservative because of alpha and beta. Okay, if we turn off alpha and beta, we have a classical statistical physics problem for which there are books written about that problem. Lincoln's one of our experts here. Okay, so to make sort of a somewhat long story short, I'll just say that H stability just deals with the fact that you'd like the energy per particle divided by the total number of particles, or the energy per particle, which is the total energy divided by the number of particles. You'd like this limit to be well behaved as n goes to infinity. That's called H stability. If it's not well behaved, then that's the catastrophic case. And for the Morse potential, you can analytically derive for the parameters in the Morse potential, you can analytically derive whether it's H stable or not. And you get a beautiful phase diagram like this.
What does the H refer to?
What is the H? Hamiltonian? What does the H refer to, Lincoln? He's the expert here on this stuff.
I think enthalpy.
Oh, is it? Okay. Okay. Thanks, Lincoln. Okay, so there's a Morse potential. So again, I don't want to spend a whole, I could spend a whole talk on this problem. You guys want to hear about coarsening, so let me get to some punchlines here by showing some movies. I think I'm going to show you one movie that actually undergoes some kind of, at least to a mother's eye, coarsening. And it's really this one on the right. So depending on the parameters of the potential, you get different morphologies of patterns. That's the punchline. So here's one pattern that's a ring. This pattern is where we see interesting coarsening. Notice that our particles are starting to form clumps. Okay? You just give them a little while. The clumps are going to get more cohesive and more well-formed after some short amount of time.
There's a difference between the left picture and the right picture. Is it initial conditions or parameters or what?
It's the parameters of the interaction potential. Okay, so now what we see is that after some time, we see beautiful, very regular, round clumps form. Okay, and these particles, so this one is sort of the last one to kind of organize itself, but it will. And if you wait a while, the clumps sometimes eat each other too. So I can't say 100% that this is really undergoing the kind of coarsening we've seen in other problems, but I wouldn't be surprised if it does. Especially if you took a really large system size. This is a fairly small system size. And but you do see the two scales here. You know, you see the full system, which is one, you know, they're all rotating around each other, and then you see these smaller clumps. And as long as you have at least two clumps, they'll maintain this rotation formation. As soon as they form one super clump, that one super clump will just go in one direction. It will just take off, and it won't stay confined in one area. It will just go.
So do you get like a renormalized dynamics where once these clumps form, you can treat them as pseudo?
I don't know. You know, this is one of the things we have. So I'm showing you something we don't know the answer to. If you were gonna ask me what are some cool coarsening problems for that we don't know the answer to, I would point at this as one possible problem. We have a lot of other things we do know. For example, at least some of them are experimentally known, some of them are analytically known. But here's a sort of a simpler example that doesn't have coarsening, for which depending on whether you're in the H stable regime for the potential or the catastrophic regime, you get different morphologies. This is going to self-organize into a mill, but with an empty core. And this mill is composed of particles all traveling with that speed square root of alpha over beta. This will also self-organize into a mill. However, there will be no empty core, and it will look much more like rigid body rotation, rather than this case over here. Yes?
Excuse me, I'm a bit lost. Can you again explain what is the dynamics here? What do errors represent?
We're just integrating that ODE model I showed on a previous slide. It was two slides before this. This one here.
Okay. So the arrow is just a vector v.
The arrow. Oh yeah, the arrow is the direction of v. Okay. And it's a fixed length. We don't change it as a function of speed. That's a really good question. So, and if you want to see, we don't do coarsening in this paper, but I think it's there. I suspect it's there. And you can, if you want to see more details about this problem, it's in the PRL, which is on my website, or if you can't get it from there, just email me. I send you a copy. Okay, so that's a neat problem.
So where were the axes moving around?
The axes were moving around because Yao Li has his own OpenGL software that will that will figure out the coordinates on the fly so that you have all the interesting feature in an ice box. And but some, for some reason he feels that he has to put axes on that, so the axes then have to move. So, but Yao Li is a whiz at writing these, developing these movies and visualizations for this kind of stuff. Yes. Martine, did you raise your hand? No, you're just stretching. Okay. Let me mention another. So speaking of Martine, who works on thin films, let me mention another class of problems that do undergo coarsening and for which there is some beautiful results in the literature. So these are models for de-wetting films. So de-wetting films, you guys all have experience with. If you take a waxy surface and you try to coat it with anything that's water-based, okay, like water-based paint, for example, it's not going to stick very well to that surface. Likewise, if you wax your car and you rain on the car, the water will bead up, okay? So that's de-wetting. Those are all examples of de-wetting. And it turns out if the layer of liquid on the surface is fairly thin, it actually satisfies a PDE that looks sort of like this, okay? So U is the thickness of the film, and the derivatives are in the spatial direction along the substrate. So it's a coding problem where we're computing the thickness of the film. And so we get this interesting problem here. So this U cubed is what we use when we have a completely wetting fluid. And this pi is what's called in the wetting literature a disjoint impression. Okay? And that's and then the model that I'm going to talk about here, the disjoint pressure that we use is motivated by van der Waals interactions, okay, which can be short or long range and can be attractive or repulsive. And if you have the right balance of these van der Waals at different scales with different power laws, you get very interesting pattern forming in this kind of model in a way that does sometimes look like what you see in real life. So here's just a picture. I actually grab this picture out of a paper by my colleagues Carl Glasner and Tomatulski that was published a few years ago. I think we have the same paper. We have a paper with Tom and Günther Grin in nonlinearity as well. Our paper in nonlinearity proves some theorems about this model, but not coarsening theorems. The first coarsening paper about this model appeared, I may have this date wrong, but I think that's right. It's Tomatulski and Glasner. It's a beautiful paper. What they do is they look at the dynamics. So let me tell you the story actually behind this. This is a great story. So Günther Grin, who is a colleague of mine from Germany, came to Duke when I used to be in the faculty at Duke, and he gave a talk about this equation. And he showed some computer simulations at the end of his talk. And he showed three drops of different sizes sitting on a thin layer. And he said, "We waited till time 15,000 and they don't change. So that's it, that's a steady state." And I looked at Günther and I said, after the talk, I said, "I don't think so. Because a steady state of this problem actually satisfies a very simple PDE, which is Laplacian of U minus pi of U equals a constant. And in one space dimension, that's a harmonic oscillator. And exact solutions of the harmonic oscillator are exactly periodic and there's nothing else you could have." Okay, so, he said, "Yeah, maybe you're right." So we went on to prove some very nice theorems about stable and unstable solutions of this model in nonlinearity. But then the question came back to, well, what was going on with those three darn drops in the simulation? So Tomatulski had a very good code. He said, "You know what, I can run that code too, or I can run it on my code." So he ran it on his code, but he let it wait even longer. And if you wait to time 30,000, all of a sudden, there's two drops instead of three drops. And if you wait even longer, finally there's one big mother drop, and that's the end of the story. So then Tom and Carl decided they were going to look at this problem, and they were able to do formal asymptotics on this problem, where it turns out that there's a very nice model. If you look at, so basically what happens is if you let these things de-wet, you get sort of, isolated drops separated by, you know, by different lengths. And you know, and if you just look at it for a while, it looks like everything's sitting still and not moving. But it turns out that these drops move on a very long time scale. And they eventually will run into each other. Big drops will lead smaller drops. And it turns out that you can actually, to leading order, derive an ODE system that describes how these drops move. You actually get a set of ordinary differential equations for the mass of the drop and the position of the drop. So it's a moving system. And here's a picture. So it turns out using that ODE model, you can write down a worldview of your drops. Here's a calculation they did on a large grid. So what we're looking at is T on this axis, X is on this axis, and each line denotes the position of a drop as a function of time, and where the line ends is where the drop disappears, evaporates. This is a 1D calculation. This model was in 1D. And look, they're computing, since it's an ODE, you can compute the heck out of it. You can run to 10 to the 7th, and they get beautiful statistical coarsening, T to the minus 2/5 power. And they have a theory to explain this, so it's all in their paper, their first paper. They have a couple of papers on this. And so you may think, well, is that the end of the story? Well, it's not, actually, because it turns out you can go back to the original PDE model and do some rigorous calculations for that. And that was recently done by Otto Rump and Supchev, published in Cyan Journal of Math Analysis just this past year. And they actually consider the PDE model, but with a different power. So when I say power, I mean, so the de-wetting model looks like this, with Quashin and U minus pi of U. Okay, this is the power I'm talking about. If I replace that 3 with a 1, I now have a problem for which we can use some ideas from optimal transport. The Wasserstein metric, which I know Rob McCann is an expert in. I'm not, but he is. And so these guys were able to take those ideas and apply them to this particular problem and to get a rigorous bound on the coarsening rate for this problem with a 1 instead of a 3. Okay, so I'm not going to tell you, since I'm not the expert on that, I'm not going to discuss the details of the proof, but I am going to show you a movie, which Dan was kind enough to send me. So this is a movie that they did, a numerical simulation of the drops coarsening. Beautiful movie. And you can see it's quite different from the Kamm-Hilliard labyrinthian coarsening process, because you really do have kind of isolated droplets in this case. But nevertheless, we have the same kinds of features, that it's some statistically self-similar with a power law behavior for which we can actually get a rigorous, at least one-sided bound on. Okay. I love this movie. This is a pretty movie. I think the reason why they're turning color is because the drops are getting taller as they coarsen, and they're using some kind of a visualization where the color represents the height of the drop. Okay, so finally, they start in close up and then they zoom out as the coarsening happens. So now we're looking at the whole computational domain. And I think they're using Neumann boundary conditions, which is why you're seeing only half a drop there. Okay, so I have like 5 minutes. I'm going to have to go fast. So these PDE models with interesting interface dynamics can actually be quite useful in modeling real experiments. So I thought I'd just mention one application of a Kahn-Hilliard-like model that we're actually using here at UCLA as a model for electrowetting. So this is a real engineering application where you have liquid trapped between two glass plates, and you actually want to move it around in a very prescribed manner. So you want to control motion, merging and splitting and motion of tiny drops of fluid. You can imagine there's a lot of applications that would care about being able to do this very well. And naturally, if you want to do this well, it's good to have a good mathematical model so you can actually try to predict what's going to happen in these devices. So here's the electrowetting device. This is Shang Wei's experiment, where we move this one drop from one cell to another, and all we're doing is changing, we're applying a local voltage to one of the plates, and that basically changes the local contact angle of the fluid and causes it to move from one square to another. You can also do droplet splitting and merging using this same kind of dynamics. here's a splitting. So now we're going to merge them by just changing the voltage back to this plate here. And there they are. Okay. So it turns out that that the motion of the interface is described by what's called the Healy-Shaw equation, which is a sharp interface model, which actually you can do formal asymptotics on the Navier-Stokes equation to derive Healy-Shaw by depth averaging through the plate direction, and that's been done a number of years ago. But it also turns out that the Healy-Shaw model can be described as an epsilon to zero limit of a phase field model as well, okay? And so what we end up doing is taking essentially the Kahn-Hilliard energy, but putting in a degenerate mobility, this rho here. So this basically gives us a one-sided Mullins-Sakharova problem, which is exactly Healy-Shaw flow. So I don't have this written here, but that, what I just told you was actually done by Carl Glasner in a paper in nonlinearity in 03. What we were able to do with Carl, Shangwei, and CJ was to take that idea and apply it now to electrowetting, where we have an additional voltage. So it turns out the voltage has a very simple representation in terms of this free energy, and it's literally just the characteristic function of the place where you have the voltage times a constant times rho in the free energy. You just add an additional term like that. What happens is that this combination of terms gives you surface energy, it's the line tension around the edge of the drop, and this additional term gives you a surface area contribution to the energy that's multiplied by the region where you have the electrowetting. So it's a really, really simple model to characterize this seemingly complex system, and it turns out to work pretty well. So here are some comparisons between our model and the real device. This is an experiment done in the lab, and this is the model. And it turns out that this time scale, you notice that the time scales are not quite on. It turns out that the time scale here is very, very sensitive to physics at the contact line, which is something that we struggle with to some degree, and a lot of people have struggled with in Healy-Shaw models. This is sort of ubiquitous in Healy-Shaw models. But if you don't pay a lot of attention to that and just look at the morphologies, you see that we are able to capture a lot of the sort of merging and splitting dynamics, and also the motion of the drop. And what we see here in our model, we've rescaled it so that omega is dimensionless. This is our electrowetting number. What omega basically does is it gives us a relative strength of the line tension versus the surface area energy in the problem. So you see, for example, in this calculation here, the motion of the droplet due to the electrowetting energy introduces a time scale that's just a little bit faster than the relaxation of the drop due to the line tension around the edge. So you see you get pretty big deformations of the drop when you move it in this case. However, with a much smaller electrowetting number, the line tension has a chance to catch up and make the drop much more circular as you try to move it across. So the model's really nice in describing a lot of the, you know, sort of the basic physics of this process. No coarsening here, although I imagine if we put in a whole bunch of drops with some interesting dynamics, we probably could get coarsening. But I thought I'd just mention this as a technological application as opposed to a sort of basic science application. Okay, so since I only have like a minute, I'll just mention that Shivan Dayan's Xiaoqing Huang, who is another young researcher here at UCLA, and I have been looking at numerical methods for statistical coarsening. So this is a really interesting problem. How do you compute these things accurately? Because you've got to compute over many, many time, you know, over long time scales and large spatial extents as well. And there's been quite a lot of work done on this recently for the Kahn-Hilliard equation. One of the methods that I particularly like is Iyer's gradient stable method, which basically takes the non-convex energy and splits it up into a convex part and a concave part. Now, this can be done many, many different ways. There's not a unique splitting for that. But if you do it, you can do it in such a way. So if you do this, if you take any convex splitting of the energy, and then you write a numerical scheme, which literally, it's very simple. You literally say that the solution of the new time level minus the old time level divided by your time step is going to be equal to minus the gradient evaluated of the convex part evaluated at the new time level plus the the gradient of the concave part evaluated at the old time level, this turns out to be unconditionally stable if you do that. So then the only question is there a way to do the splitting so that you have a fast solver for the implicit part? And if you have that, then you're really good to go. So that's the key idea. It's really simple. It's not my idea. It sort of, dates back, at least as far as I know, to this paper by David Iyer. Turns out there's an easy way to do it for Kahn-Hilliard, which I won't go into all the details. And not only that, but we're able to, this is actually a calculation that Shiven did, to derive a rigorous bound for, like our statistical coarsening, only for the numerical scheme using the convex splitting. So that's a new result that Shiven's calculation. Not written up, so you're just hearing about this from me. But it turns out that, so I know I have to finish, so I'm going to, let me tell you. It turns out that you can run into trouble. You can still run into trouble. And so notice that was a one-sided bound. So where you run into trouble is if you take too big a time step. If you take too big a time step and you try to follow the statistical decay of the energy, then what happens is all of a sudden you don't actually decay the way that the system really decays. You actually decay slower. Okay, so this is just a calculation that Xiao Qing did with different fixed DTs starting at this time right here, and you can see that there's a big divergence of whether you fall. So the energies are always on one side of the sort of the numerically resolved energy, but they're always slower. Okay, so that's a drawback to using a convexity splitting method, is that it can fool you into taking a big time step, which actually may not be the accurate, it may not give you an accurate result. So there's been some work in the physics literature. I gotta give credit to people who've done work on this. So there are some recent papers in the physics literature looking at how to scale the time step with time in order to get accurate simulation for Kahn-Hilliard. And there's some really nice papers just came out in the last couple of years on that problem. So I'll just stop there, and thank you all for coming.